Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Press Gazette Podcast, Future of Media Explained, where this week we're talking about why the media should embrace neurodiversity. I'm UK editor Charlotte Tobit, and I'm here with editor-in-chief Dominic Ponsford. Hi, Dom.
Hi, Charlotte.
So this is slightly different to our usual kind of very business-focused podcast, but it's quite exciting because we've done a reader survey, haven't we?
Yeah, we've done quite a big bit of reader research around neurodiversity in the media.
So before we go any further, do you want to define that for us? What are we including in that? Cause we've taken it from the NHS, haven't we? Like, we haven't just made up a definition.
Well, so neurodiversity is quite a new term in itself. I think it's only really been widely used sort of in fairly recent years. And I think we're talking about people with lifelong conditions that mean their brains are wired differently from your neurotypical person. People that fall into that definition are ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia. But the main sort of categories of person we're looking at are the two sort of biggest, the two biggest categories that came back in our survey are ADHD and autism. And I think the term neurodiversity, or people who are neurodivergent, it's also to do with not just talking about deficits, but also talking about strengths as well. And the idea that these aren't illnesses, although it's not perhaps a picnic to be ADHD or dyslexic, but these are the sort of genetic variants, if you like. These are just different brains than your average person has.
Yeah, there are often things that they kind of better at, or you know, they often have like a strength, a skill, something that they love. It's just that other things they might find more difficult. So what were the key findings that came out of the survey in that sense?
I think overall we should probably just say, like, the headlines are we emailed 18,000 of our subscribers, of whom about 6,000 opened the email, and of whom 136 got back to us. So 136 is a decent amount. So of the 136 who filled out our survey, 47%, so nearly half, consider themselves to be sort of neurodiverse. That's not to say that half our readers are neurodiverse, because maybe you're more likely to fill out the survey if you are. But it also suggests there's an awful lot of people with ADHD and autism in the media. Because I'm sure, it's, you know, how many people bother to fill out surveys? You know, they've got other stuff to do. So I'm sure this is just a small snapshot. But we found 46 respondents with ADHD, 24 with autism. Part of the survey was quite a kind of, sort of talking about strengths and weaknesses. And I think some of the challenges that people with ADHD have, they sort of talk about focus, timekeeping can be very difficult. Autism as well, you know, multitasking can be very hard. Quite a few dyslexic people got back to us, so you know, spelling can be very hard. Yeah, and all these are sort of things you think, oh my goodness, yeah, that's such a no-no for journalism. But then the strengths that they bring to it are things like, you know, amazing creativity. It's especially with ADHD, because that's sort of quite a brain that sort of skits around. Some people say it's a sort of almost like their creative superpower. And with autism, you know, a lot of people talk about focus. Same with ADHD. People talk about hyperfocus and, you know, being able to really hone in on sort of special interests. So it's quite interesting. Very mixed picture. One of the big things that comes across is a huge amounts of ignorance in the industry. Most of the people who filled out our survey said they'd never told anyone at work. They kind of kept it secret. And most people said that their employers, you know, pay lip service at best to kind of accommodating people with these sort of conditions. But I mean, the full details are on the website, but it's a very, very interesting snapshot of an area of sort of diversity that we don't talk about much, do we? We hardly talk about it at all, Prescott.
No, I mean, yeah, as you say, lots of talk in recent years of gender diversity, ethnic diversity, people with disabilities, physical disabilities. But then, this is kind of a lesser discussed. But you've spoken to a couple of very interesting case studies, haven't you? So do you want to introduce us?
So I'll start off with Lydia, who's a very impressive person. She's a freelance journalist with autism. She's got a couple of other things as well, which she goes into. And I think she's, you know, really interesting example of the sort of missed opportunities for employers, because she said she found it impossible to get a staff job, partly because, you know, the interview process was so sort of rubbish for someone with some of the challenges which she has. But if you look at her career now, you know, you can go look at her website. She's got, you know, cuttings for all sorts of different publications. She's also the deputy editor of a publication. So she's doing really well. Yeah, and she just sort of shed some light, really, on what it's like to be a journalist, to be autistic, and, you know, some of the challenges she has, but also some of the strengths she brings to it as well. Hi, Lydia Wilkins. Welcome to the Press Gazette podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you're a freelance journalist. You've done lots of things. I see you've worked for lots of different titles. You've done some investigative journalism. You've written a book, the Autism Friendly Cookbook, and you're the editor-in-chief of Disability Review magazine. Is that correct?
That is. I think that's always the way when you're freelance, having to do kind of the thing of not having all eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, very wise. Very wise in the current market, definitely. So, listen, we've done this research and we found out that there's... there seems to be quite a lot of autistic people working in journalism. So I thought, first of all, maybe just tell us a bit about yourself in terms of your having a slightly different brain from the neurotypical person. How do you describe yourself?
So I would describe myself as being a disabled journalist who covers and specialises in disability and social inequality issues. That is very simply because I have more than just one condition. So it frustrates me when we have discussions about diversity, inclusion, the kind of the nuance in that is missed. I'm not just an autistic journalist, despite the fact that I'm an award-winning freelance journalist and editor. It's something that's used to be very often kind of reductive almost. It does not paint the full picture. I was diagnosed with what was called Asperger syndrome and is now called autism spectrum disorder when I was 2 months shy of turning 16, but that was at the end of a 3.5 year process from start to finish. So I'm 25 now, nearly a decade diagnosed. I found out recently I also have dyspraxia, which is another form of neurodiversity, but I'm also a long COVID patient, which has kind of like an alphabet of conditions that you just seem to pick up, really.
So this is quite a tough question to ask, sorry, but what are the sort of the main challenges you face? We'll get on to strengths, I guess, after that, but it might be interesting to know the challenges as well.
So I cannot read people. I have no idea what the facial expressions mean. That does not mean that I do not feel emotions. It's the thing of not being able to put the kind of the expression to the appropriate emotion word, which makes kind of reading people and situations very difficult, which very obviously, in order to be a journalist in the typical sense, it is something that you need. If you're going into an interview scenario, you need to be able to read if somebody's cross, if they're angry, if they're sad, if they're happy. It's also in the way in which questions and conversations are phrased. Sometimes they can be a tripping point if somebody is kind of using that as a way to sort of, I don't know, to use that against you, so to speak. It's also in terms of what's called executive functioning. So everybody has this. It's the ability to sequence tasks. So if you're working in a newsroom, how many assignments do you have? How many things do you have to do all at once? And when do they need to be filed? And what stages are they at? And how do you juggle this? If the sense of executive functioning is impaired, it can create challenges. Everybody surely remembers when they were in education, for example, there's always the person in the one class who always forgets the pen and the paper and all that kind of thing. That's a very classic example.
And there are often some sensory issues that go along with it, on their sort of sensitivity to noise or light or food, I don't know.
Autism spectrum disorder is a spectrum, so not every person is the same. I really want to stress this simply because I'm not a mouthpiece, and people very often have this idea when we have conversations that we are all the same type thing. So every autistic person has what's called a sensory profile, and it may present differently per person. So I'm hypersensitive to noise in that I cannot process and I cannot filter noise particularly well, but I can also hear more of it. So if you're going into any type of environment or there's a transition, it can become complicated pretty quickly and it can become overwhelming. In terms of food and that type of thing, it's such a stereotype, but it's the thing of the autistic person and beige food and not being able to, you know, sort of stomach, excuse the pun, you know, sort of hot food, chili food, change in food and that type of thing.
Thanks, Lydia. Thanks for that sort of rundown. I just think it's useful because I think probably, you know, probably a lot of people, the classic thing is the film Rain Man, which, you know, is a great film in the 80s, but that might be some people's perception of, you know, autism. You know, it's great for you to give us a sort of nuanced view on that.
Can I just caveat? Sorry, Rain Man is not based on an autistic person. It's written about somebody who was thought to be autistic at the time, but he had two separate things. So he was a savant and he had a genetic condition, which is completely different. Autistic people are not savants. They are not geniuses. It's a completely separate thing. I just want to really make that clear because it's such a misconception. Even now, if I just go and talk to a colleague or someone, it's always the thing of kind of like the semantics in the sense of, oh, geniuses. We're not. We're a very neutral concept. We're just, you know, human beings.
Thanks for that. The data says that there's a lot of autistic people are unemployed, like maybe like a third are actually employed.
It's something like that, because it's also the National Statistics Office, I think that's what it's called. They actually started to count that separately from employed data of the neurotypical population the year prior to the pandemic.
So you've sort of done amazingly well to be employed as an autistic person. You're not only employed, you're employed in one of the most competitive fields, which is journalism, which is a very tough field to get into anyway. So I'd be really interested to hear about your journey into the profession and how you managed to get going as a journalist.
So I'm self-employed. I've never been employed by a news organization. I work for myself. I was always interested in kind of words and books and publishing, but I was never able to do fiction. When I was a child, it was very much kind of, oh, this person must be the next Jacqueline Wilson, or, you know, they must write the next Percy Jackson series type thing. I can't do fiction. It sounds potentially really stupid me saying this, but it was very kind of, oh, if I can't write that, then I can just sort of arrange the facts on a page, which is effectively what journalism sort of is, to arrange and hopefully be accurate and all that kind of thing. I remember being told kind of, you know, that I wasn't going to do anything, that I was stupid, unintelligent, that kind of thing. I hated being in education. So I think how careers advisors work in schools, there was so much outdated information, so I had to go looking for it. I ended up going for the Journalism Diversity Fund in order to do my NCTJ after college. I was just amazed to find out that they had awarded this to me. I remember being absolutely terrified of the panel interview. I had the world's worst cold. I did the NCTJ and I went freelance, and that's it, really. I've been freelance all of my working life.
And have you sort of applied for jobs in newsrooms or worked in newsrooms? What was your experience like of that? And maybe is there anything, you know, any sort of adjustments that could have been made to make that better for you, do you think?
I'm trying not to laugh at this. So I have applied, and if anyone's listening to this, I would say, frankly, don't bother. The one newspaper that actually seemed to understand the Equality Act and anything like reasonable adjustments or actually having a understanding of disability, because autism is considered to be a disability under the law. It's literally in the legislation. The one newspaper that actually had time for me is the newspaper that is generally held up and ridiculed as being quite a hateful paper. I'll allow you to guess which one, but I'm not going to comment. Even kind of just applying for anything, there's such a tokenistic kind of thing. I would go in for interviews and it would always be the thing of, oh, we've just like hired you because you fill our diversity criteria. I've been told this on multiple occasions. I'd get through, and then it would always be the thing of where it was always kind of, oh, we prefer the autistic man compared to an autistic woman. Again, something that news organisations have said in front of me. I have had one interview where any kind of reasonable adjustment was made. I didn't get it because at the time I did not have enough experience, because I was literally just out of training college. But that was actually on my merits rather than being an issue. That particular organisation didn't have any kind of framework whatsoever. So when I asked for reasonable adjustments, it was actually quite nice because they actually came back to me and said, we don't have anything like that. Can you advise and then we can do your interview? So we talk about diversity, we talk about awareness, but we are not actually doing anything. I'm sick of the fact that this is even a question. We are not actually doing or even listening. We're not actually taking any kind of action, I would argue, that has nuance. It doesn't have a pan-disability approach. It doesn't actually have any idea about intersectionality. And then it's the thing of, oh, because my generation are kind of, you know, outspoken, that sort of thing, anything about this is very often written off as being quote-unquote woke.
I mean, it looks like it's been their loss, because you've been published all over the place. You've written a book, you know, you've written for the Metro, the Independent, Daily Mail. So, you know, great, you've done it anyway. I mean, what are the sort of strengths that your brain kind of gives you, maybe, as a journalist? I know you said there's some challenges there, but are there some things which maybe help you, or which are strengths as well?
I have the nickname from my editor and a colleague of mine of being the detail freak. I am better when it comes to long form projects, simply because it's easier for me to have a mastery of the detail and sometimes picking up the stuff that people have missed, or maybe following up on stuff in the respect of somebody might have missed this. Last year at the Sir Harold Evans Summit that was hosted for the first time by Tina Brown, I got to meet a hero of mine. They used to work for the BBC. They, I believe, are neurodivergent. And they had this such great piece of advice where they were saying about when we talk about masking, masking is generally taken as being not a particularly great thing to do because it can have an impact on mental health. But in order to succeed, he turned to me and he said, you need to be able to utilise that. So to adapt to interview circumstances, to be able to adapt to employer, people you're pitching, that kind of thing. Best piece of advice I was ever given.
And what are some things which employers could do if they're starting to think about having a bit more of an enlightened approach to this? And I imagine a lot of people thinking, well, it's nice to have people who think differently in news organisations, especially at the moment when the industry's got so many challenges, and doing things the way you've always done it is probably not going to be, you know, the best solution. Getting some different people in who might have some different ideas might be helpful. What are the sort of things that employers could do to make interviews, recruitment and employment a little bit easier, do you think, for people who might have some of the challenges that you have?
Well, first of all, give a damn about the Equality Act. And I say that in the sense of it is beyond frustrating to go into a newsroom, to an interview, to be told, oh, we've got these reasonable adjustments, not to be given them, or having to do the explaining and therefore the emotional labour to a newsroom, to HR, to whoever, that is what you're entitled to. Reasonable adjustments are there for a reason. It makes things better. Second of all, we have this very dated as being kind when I say this. We have a dated view that access for disability, it's apparently costly, it's apparently expensive. That's not true. It's even just things such as giving interview questions ahead of time to people so that they are able to script. They're not rehearsing. This is the way in which people like me are able to talk. It's what I'm doing in order to be able to talk in this podcast, for example. It's just very simple things like that. Rather than expecting us to have to do all the explaining, why should we? We should have moved past this a long time ago. I think in the sense of diversity and inclusion and all that kind of thing, it also potentially answers the question around trust in journalism, particularly in the sense of people and the communities that are covered and all that kind of thing. You cannot possibly argue that newspapers are representative of the UK. The data is already there. We've known this for a while. If we actually employed with barriers that are no longer there, so actually working and working to be accepting rather than just awareness of people like me, could this not do a world of good in the sense of it builds trust? There's a question.
100%, 100%, I agree.
I think that there is very often an emphasis on ethics and ethical journalism, but you cannot have ethics and ethical journalism without inclusion of everyone. So earlier I used the term pan-disability. When we have diversity, inclusion and all that kind of thing, very often the image that comes to mind is someone who is a wheelchair user. We need to remember very often that people, in terms of trying to reach targets and all that kind of thing, that there is no one particular look. It's also not doing the job if you're just going, oh, we're just going to tick this box because we've got this person with this condition or that condition. It needs to have a multifaceted approach. And I think very often that that's forgotten.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for that. And it's worth noting, isn't it, that, you know, things like autism and ADHD particularly, it's not a small minority, is it? It's, you know, perhaps 2 or 3% of the population in each case. So, yeah.
Very often it's forgotten that on the government's last consensus, disabled people, so disabled is in the Equality Act definition, so that includes neurodivergence, it includes in some respects ageing, it includes anxiety, depression, mental health and all that. We are nearly 25% of the population and it is growing. That is the world's largest minority group and it is the fastest growing. Can we afford to be ignoring or to not be covering this in a way that is detrimental or reductive? I don't think we can afford that anymore.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Dom, you've got a second person for us. Very exciting podcast. Have two interviewees. So who are we going to hear from next?
So I also spoke to Daryl Morris, who's a journalist at Times Radio with ADHD. He's someone who he said sort of struggled at school, as a lot of people with ADHD too. But then he sort of discovered, you know, radio and found that it was a profession where, you know, some of the traits he has, as someone with ADHD, could actually be, you know, really useful to him. So he told me, you know, a bit more about what it's like to have ADHD, but also about how it's actually sort of helped him in a way to have, you know, a successful career in journalism. So hi, Daryl Morris. Thanks for coming on the Press Gazette podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you're a journalist at Times Radio, yeah, and you've also got ADHD, which puts you in, you know, according to our survey, you're not alone by any means in news media. Quite a lot of our readers categorise themselves as having a sort of neurodiverse condition, and the most prevalent by far is ADHD. Before telling us about what you do in your job and how you got into journalism, can you just tell us a little bit about ADHD as it affects you? Because I know it comes from this research, it comes with some strengths which are helpful in journalism, but I think it's probably got some big challenges as well. So can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, of course. I mean, ADHD, I mean, it is a neuro disability, effectively. I mean, it is technically a disability, which feels a bit odd because I don't feel disabled, necessarily. Which is kind of, you know, the point, isn't it? You know, very rarely people do feel disabled. But the reality, of course, is that it is a disability. The science, Dominic, is that it effectively is a lack of blood flow to my frontal cortex. And it means that lots and lots of sort of complicated things in the sort of complicated mesh that is our brain. But it effectively means that I have a dopamine deficiency, and that my brain is sort of lacking dopamine and is quite thirsty for it. Now, that manifests itself in being easily distracted, you know, is kind of the central pillar of what people understand ADHD to be, I think, and struggling to focus on tasks often. You know, as with lots of things in neurodiversity, it's a spectrum, right? So some people have more intense symptoms than others. Emotional regulation, struggling sometimes to kind of regulate your emotions, can be one symptom. Suffering with sensory overload is another symptom that actually I've become a little bit more conscious of in recent years. There are times when actually I've become a little bit overwhelmed if there's quite a lot going on around me. And a sort of plethora of symptoms like that. I suppose, you know, there's another way to describe being distracted, which is curious. And, you know, I think one of the sort of, yeah, I spoke to a neuroscientist about this a couple of weeks ago for an episode of the Times' Story podcast, and he said that, you know, one of the things that we find a lot with people who have ADHD is that they manage to thrive if they can find their kind of niche in the world. And I think we'll talk more about journalism in a moment, I guess, but that kind of principle of being curious, of kind of, you know, all of the best stories I've ever come across of when I've been distracted because I should have been doing something else, right? And so it kind of manifests itself in that way as well.
I'm sure you'll probably have seen articles or online comments where there's a lot of more people being diagnosed currently with ADHD and autism than ever before. There's some people say, well, yeah, it's overdiagnosed or it's medicalizing things where people, you know, would have just got on with it in the past or whatever. Well, I mean, should we just put that one to bed quickly, if you like, in terms of this idea that it's not like a valid, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm one of those people who sort of feels like, you know, a lot of that debate is fine, you know, and it's perfectly reasonable. And in a free society where we are, you know, not only free to, but frankly obliged to stress test power and authority and, you know, perceived wisdom and, you know, all that sort of stuff, that's absolutely fine. I think that I would say that the notion that ADHD doesn't exist at all, you know, which is something that you still see printed in newspapers and, you know, championed by commentators, is not true. We can say conclusively, objectively, that isn't true. It is clinically proven. I've outlined some science. I have a medical condition that we can absolutely conclusively put to bed. Then if you want to have a conversation about the number of people that are being diagnosed, we have a climate at the moment where a lot of people in the last couple of years, because of it being a very potent social trend, people have been making lots of ADHD-based content, therefore recognizing symptoms that they themselves experience in that content that they've been watching and seeking help and a diagnosis and seeking to understand their own brain. That doesn't make it a trend. It makes it trending, but it doesn't make it a trend or trendy per se. And I think there's another really important point, which is that a recent study of a massive collection of studies across developed countries suggested, or comparable countries, suggested that the UK should have a population with ADHD, or a percentage of the population with ADHD in the UK should be between 3-4%. And we are miles away. I mean, we are miles and miles and miles away. We haven't even breached a percentage point of people having a diagnosis of ADHD. So statistically, we still underdiagnose in this country. But I think one of the things that obviously has sort of piqued people's interest is that you have these really long waiting lists. Then, of course, the conversation turns to medication and whether we are medicating some human experiences and whether the pharmaceutical industry have exploited this problem and whether we need, you know, everybody needs to be diagnosed and needs to have medication. I don't take medication for what it's worth. I did when I was at school for a brief period, but as an adult, for better or worse, I've chosen to sort of deal with it in other ways that we might come on to. I think those are all very valid conversations and very valid debates that we should have as a society. But the idea that it doesn't exist is not true. And the idea that we are overdiagnosing just isn't borne out by the facts.
You did a great podcast for The Times on ADHD, and you went into your background a little bit. And I got the impression that you struggled a bit at the school. Tell us a bit about what you ended up with kind of qualifications-wise, and how you got your start in journalism.
I got nothing qualifications-wise, basically.
Yeah. I'm sure lots of people listening will be very pleased to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, it is common, that, isn't it? It's common to hear that these days. And I often describe my time at school as being restless. I think there was lots about the system and lots about the kind of the sort of rhythms of mainstream education that didn't work for me. Quite a lot of them did. And actually, it was an interesting era when I was at school in the sort of noughties, because I graduated high school in 2008, maybe. And that was an era. And I got my diagnosis when I was 8 or 9 or 10, over that period anyway. It took a few years to kind of get everything in place. But that period from those late 90s to the late noughties were a sort of real, there was a real acceleration. I mean, you think you've had an acceleration now. There was a real acceleration in that period of understanding ADHD and schools being, you know, I was the only kid really, I think, in a school of thousands with ADHD. But there was an effort to try to understand that, to put in place some things that would help me. And, you know, one quick example of that is I would always kind of struggle a little bit in English. And my teacher, Mrs. Smith, noticed that I was really good in group discussions. I could understand, you know, subtext and character development and all that sort of stuff. You know, I really, really got it. And I was able to really effectively articulate it in a group discussion. But when it came to writing it down in an essay, I crumbled. I just couldn't. That pressure of doing it in that moment for that hour just didn't work for me. And so she allowed me to do my exam orally. So an examiner came in and she asked me the questions. And I would love to end this story by saying I got an A in English. I got a B. But it was a lot better than I was anticipated to get. So there were things like that being put in place. And then actually, Dominic, what happened was my school set up a radio station and that changed my life. And that was the era when, you know, schools had the funding to do things like, and there was quite a bit of money sloshing about in those days, wasn't there? So schools had the chance to kind of do things like establish extracurricular activities like radio stations. And I found my niche and I found my stride. And I fell in love with, I was already kind of into media and radio and television, and I already consumed a lot of content, and I was doing quite a lot of acting as well. So I was doing performance and I was into media as a concept. But then when the chance came along to be part of my school's radio station, it changed my life. And suddenly all of those qualities that were destructive in my life, suddenly, like, you know, being distracted, aka curious, performance, able to articulate myself verbally so much better than I could in writing, in exam formats, all of those things suddenly became my best asset.
And that's led you to the sort of career in broadcasting that you've got now. Is there anything that you think employers could do or should do to sort of encourage and support people with ADHD? You know, it's clear there's a lot of strengths. There might be barriers to entry for the industry, and there might be things which employers could do to make the sort of environment more beneficial for you.
You know, it is a tricky one, isn't it, to kind of know what is needed and where the kind of boundaries are. And I suppose, look, my answer, my best sort of answer to that question is, you know, as you would anybody, any good employer would want to build the scaffolding in their business that allows people to bring the best out of themselves, that brings the best out of their employees, right? You know, that is just a pillar present in any successful business. So you just need to apply that to people who have neurodivergent. And I suppose the first kind of most important thing that you can do is talk to people and listen to them. And everybody's a little bit different. There are kind of fundamentals that connect people who are who have ADHD. I mean, I don't have, you know, autism, but it's, you know, obviously on the similar spectrum, and therefore there are some crossovers and there's overlaps. Dyslexia is obviously quite a big overlap as well amongst some of those neurodivergent conditions. You just speak to people, listen to what their life is like. Let them explain to you. Let your employee explain to you where they do and don't thrive, and then build scaffolding in their job, or let them, or empower people to build scaffolding in their professional lives that helps to support them in the bits where they struggle and gives them the space to thrive in the areas that they succeed. I've got some really obvious examples for me, which is that I really heavily rely on my kind of calendar and Google Docs and the notes section of my phone to bring together ideas that my brain is kind of firing off all of the time. I'm brilliant at coming up with ideas. I'm less good at getting through the sort of trudge through the process of bringing them about and making them happen and that kind of thing. And so I have a lot of scaffolding in my life that I've put in place to help me with the bits that I know that I'm not as good at. And I also give myself the space and the freedom to create and to come up with ideas. And it isn't always that simple. I mean, to be honest with you, in an ideal world, there are some elements of my job with Times Radio that I would probably do differently. I'm in charge of booking some of our sort of staple guests, right? So normally a production team would do that, but the way that my production team is set up, I actually take, even though I'm the presenter, I take on the responsibility of doing that. And I am terrible at being organized, right? Organization just isn't one of my strengths. With ADHD, you can end up being creative, but slightly chaotic. There is a sort of slightly chaotic energy to the way that you create, which is brilliant and has lots of benefits, but it doesn't lend itself to having, you know, two paper reviewers booked and in the right place, and they know what time they're going to be on, and you know who it's going to be, and there's a structure to pass on to your production team. So we have, you know, a very rigid Google Doc where I can work from, and that it's kind of color coordinated to the way that I know that I'll be able to kind of properly function with it. And my team also know to sometimes give me a little bit of slack if it doesn't necessarily work in the right way. And I've got members of my team who I know are neurodivergent, or I know that they have skills in other areas, and I'm willing to give them a little bit of slack if there's a bit of their job that they haven't quite nailed because they were focusing on other stuff. And so I think, you know, talking to each other, being patient, and building that scaffolding where your building needs a little bit of reinforcement are the sort of keys to making sure that you get the very best out of people.
Well, thanks for that, Daryl. One final question. We've had a lot of chat around diversity in recent years in the media, certainly, and yes, an undoubtedly good thing. Well, you know, I guess to a certain extent, maybe it can feel like a box-ticking exercise or like sort of, you know, signalling something. But my sense is that when it comes to neurodiversity, there really is the opportunity there for employers to get, you know, to have, if you're in a creative business, having people who think differently, you know, could be a real benefit for you that you might want to encourage. But I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, because obviously employing someone with, you know, neurodivergent profile probably comes with a little bit of baggage as well. You know, a little bit, they might be a little bit harder to employ in some ways because they need different things. But what would be your sort of message to an employer in a way from your point of view?
Yeah, you struck on something really important there, I think, Dominic, which is that there are enormous assets in a neurodivergent brain. I can obviously only speak for ADHD, really, because that's my area of expertise and lived experience. But, you know, for me, there's this other phenomenon that comes with ADHD, which is hyperfocus. So on the other kind of extreme end of being distracted a lot, which, of course, also means curious, is that once you find yourself fixated on something, the sort of hyperfocus triggers, and it's a really weird feeling, actually, that's quite hard to explain. It's almost like you enter, it is almost literally feels like you enter a tunnel, and I try and tap into it as often as I can, and it's quite exhausting. You often come out the other end of it feeling absolutely drained. But in that period, in that moment of being in a tunnel, your hyperfocus kicks in and you will do the very best work that you have ever done. And you will do work better, richer, more detailed than than those who are, I think, neurotypical. And so there's a really powerful, potent combination, which is being distracted, aka curious, stumbling across something during those moments of distraction, which triggers a hyperfocus, and then working so damn hard on that thing that it becomes something very, very special. And that is perfect for journalism. And it's absolutely perfect for what I do as well, which is, you know, I sort of spend my week kind of flitting around, looking for stories, thinking of things I might want to talk about, pitching documentaries, coming across things that I kind of really am interested in. I'm currently working on, we're in production on a documentary at the moment for Radio 4, which is going to air in July. And I found this story a couple of years ago, and I've spent the last few years just utterly obsessed with it, and spending an enormous amount of time on it and dedicating a huge amount of my life to it. And I wouldn't have found that story had it not been for ADHD, and I almost certainly wouldn't have done it to the degree I have were it not for hyperfocus kicking in. I was having a conversation with my fiance about this the other day, because we're going to have a child, and we were sort of talking about whether or not that child having ADHD would be a good thing or not, because it's hereditary as well. And she said, "Oh, but you always talk about how great it is to have ADHD and how much of an asset it is for you." And I was thinking, actually, no, I definitely wouldn't wish it on my child. You know, it is also still a disability, and it is also still chaos. It's still a daily struggle. There are still enormous amounts of there are still just battles you have every single day with your own brain. But knowing that it's happening, knowing what's going on in your brain, understanding that you're not stupid, you're not an idiot, you're not necessarily even that deficient. It is just the way that your brain is wired, and there are things that you can do to help you through it, and there are things that you can do to help you cope and thrive, you know, survive and thrive, is so unbelievably important. And, you know, that's why I kind of often push back against this overdiagnosis thing, because a diagnosis can change your life. It changed my life. It helped me understand my brain. I have no idea where I would be right now if I hadn't understood what was going on in my brain and how to manage it when it was tough and use it in areas where it was an asset. So that would be my sort of biggest plea to employers is, and people who have ADHD and parents is, you know, and actually anybody who's engaged in this subject really is, you know, understand it, understand the process of how it works, and give people the scaffolding they need to survive and the space that they need to thrive.
Brilliant. Good note to finish on. Thanks, Daryl.
Pleasure, Daryl. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Daryl, and thank you, Dom, for two great interviews this week. So I think a pertinent thing that we want to get out of this is what employers can take from it and maybe what they can do better. So what would you say to them?
So one of the key things the people said in the research is to sort of try and understand the conditions a bit better as well. Someone said, you know, when it comes to ADHD, people just think about, you know, naughty kids sort of, you know, throwing chairs across a classroom or something because they're being disruptive. They said, you know, it's you know, helpful to sort of take the time just to understand a little bit more about what ADHD means as an adult. So I think it means that people may have struggle focusing, they may struggle with deadlines, timekeeping and things, but they may also be able to bring a degree of focus and which means they can produce sort of incredibly high quality work and to also be, you know, sort of highly creative as well. You think, you know, in journalism, probably the creativity could almost trump the other things because there are workarounds, you know, for some of the other problems, challenges you might have. But, you know, how many people come up with really great ideas? You know, what do you want more of as an editor? Similarly with autism. It sounds like for employers, there are some, you know, relatively easy things that they could do which could make life a lot more comfortable for autistic people. It can be around sort of giving them space to sort of recharge, you know, maybe a quiet space, being flexible working, you know, allowing them to wear noise-cancelling headphones, you know, accepting that they may have some sort of, you know, sensory sensitivities around things. You know, they may not, you know, enjoy necessarily face-to-face meetings, or they may want to have their camera off, you know, whatever it is. But I feel like, you know, the first thing is just for employers to really sort of get their head around, you know, what these things are and to be open to sort of making some, you know, relatively minor accommodations, really, which could make your employees a lot happier, but which could also encourage, you know, some, you know, really, really valuable people to join your organisation, because as the sort of those interviews illustrate, and as our research has found, sort of neurodivergent people can bring a lot of different things to your workforce that you're not gonna get from your sort of neurotypical person. So they're sort of well worth having as employees. But you know, if you take autistic people, just as one example, they're only in the UK, apparently only 29% of them are employed. So they're sort of very underused, aren't they? And that's sort of tremendously sad.
Wow, yeah, I didn't know that stat. I guess all of this is, I think, just suggesting that it's not one size fits all in an office or a newsroom, and kind of quite easy changes can be made to help people do the best work they can. Sounds great.
And not just in the workplace as well. We did a conference in New York last year, and which involved lots of like busy round tables with lots of chat in quite a noisy room, which would actually be very, very hard work for someone with autism potentially, because it's a bit of a sensory overload for them, and lots of different things to process at the same time. And actually, one of our delegates came up to us and just said, "Look, you know, I've got autism, so you know, I find this environment quite tricky. Is it okay if I just come over and, you know, chat to someone else here in this quiet space?" I thought, wow, you know, it never even crossed my mind to accommodate people who might not, you know, might not be able to cope with the kind of busy environment we've laid on, you know, but they might also want to be involved in the conference in some way. So, yeah, lots to think about. You know, on our website, the full details of the research, there's quite a lot of suggestions in there about how, you know, people who work in the media can be a little bit more helpful to neurodivergent colleagues.
Hopefully this has been really useful to lots of people, and people have learned some things. So yeah, as Dom says, find a bit more information and ideas on pressgazette.co.uk. Thanks so much, Dom. See you in a couple of weeks. I've been Press Gazette UK editor Charlotte Tobit with editor-in-chief Dominic Ponsford, and we're produced by Suze Cooper. Please leave us a review, subscribe, download, share with your colleagues and friends, and we'll see you soon.